There are so many issues throughout all levels of government that smart Christians need to view it as a way to care for our neighbor by making good decisions.
Molly Hemingway talking about her joint presentation with her husband, Mark, at the 2020 Virtual Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
The federal government has gotten much more involved in family formation or family destruction, abortion, other issues. And there are so many ways in which it's important for us to think about how we can defend the weak and vulnerable among us by making good decisions.
You can watch journalists Molly and Mark Hemingway making the case for Christian political engagement at this year's Virtual Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. The premier conference for Christian laity is Friday, July 24th and Saturday, July 25th. The $135 registration fee includes the ability to watch a live stream and a recording. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org.
Marriage is a social justice issue for children. And if we are not doing marriage, if we're not encouraging men to commit to the women they're making babies with, regardless of their race, our society is doomed.
Giving cross-sex hormones to a patient with gender dysphoria and referring them for plastic surgery to alter their sex organs is the same as giving a patient with anorexia nervosa a strict diet and referring her for stomach stapling.
We should not revert to the old creation as Christians when dealing with race and racism, but let's live within the new creation that God has given as a gift to us through Christ.
And just as any little child crawls into the lap of its father to show where his hurts are or to list his complaints, that's what our Lord invites us to do.
Summer Greek students at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, love listening to Issues Etc. while studying Greek.
Alpha, beta, gamma, delta, epsilon, beta, eta, theta.
Ideas do matter, there's no doubt about it. What one believes determines what one does, most of the time. In the case of the sexual revolution, all of the time, those with the bad ideas of the sexual revolution have been doing something about it for decades and decades, and they have been legally, socially, in terms of polling and opinion, winning almost every time. Why is it that conservatives who have better ideas, good ideas, well, they can defend their ideas, they can show how their ideas are better than those of the left, but they don't seem to be able to make much traction in America's institutions. They seem to be losing that particular debate. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc., coming to you live from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to talk about conservative ideas and activism with Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse, founder and president of the Ruth Institute. After that, Mark Hemingway of Real Clear Investigations joins us. He has written recently about intellectual diversity in higher education. Some states are actually enacting laws that require intellectual diversity on campus. We'll find out why. Pastor Peter Bender joins us for our series on Lutheran catechesis. He's going to talk about one of his favorite things, creating a culture of catechesis and prayer in a Christian congregation. Then we'll talk about the short-term future of public education post and during pandemic. Joy Pullman, managing editor of The Federalist, will be our guest. Joining us to talk about conservative ideas and activism, Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse, founder and president of the Ruth Institute. She taught economics for 15 years at Yale and George Mason Universities. She's senior research fellow in economics for the Acton Institute and author of several books, including her latest, The Sexual State, and a recent column for the American Mind titled Ideas Don't Have Consequences. Jennifer, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
When you hear your fellow social conservatives say, we're in a battle of ideas for the hearts and minds of the American people, how do you respond?
Well, you know, I like the hearts and minds part because you need to be inspiring people and they need to be using their heads and not running around like chickens with their heads cut off. But this battle for ideas thing is really starting to bug me, Todd, because a lot of times the people who are talking about ideas just don't seem to want to get out from behind their desks. They just keep talking about ideas and never actually implement those ideas. So I have to say I'm a little bit frustrated with the whole situation.
Another saying that we often hear is that ideas have consequences. Well, You say not necessarily.
Well, you know, as a matter of fact, I just wrote an article called Ideas Don't Have Consequences, Actions Have Consequences. And the way that ideas are relevant is if they inspire you to action, number one, and if the ideas are correct, then you're going to be taking actions that are good and decent and constructive and building the kingdom of God. So you have to get the ideas right. You could say, as a mathematician, I would say, it's a necessary condition, but it's not a sufficient condition. It's not enough to have the ideas. That's the point. And that's what I'm trying to say in that article, Todd. And that's what I would say to anybody who cares to listen.
You have had to come around on this yourself because you have had a long career dealing with ideas. You say you've won a lot of debates even those ideas.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. You know, as a matter of fact, Todd, you know, now that you're bringing this up, you and I have been talking to each other about social conservative issues for almost 20 years now, because I think we discovered each other when I wrote Love and Economics back in 2001. So, you know, we've been talking about ideas for a long time. And I think it was around 2013 that I realized that there was absolutely nothing wrong with my ideas. And the people I was debating and engaging with, you know, you could sort of see them, you know, limping away with their tails between their legs because they didn't really have anything to say. But they kept winning the war. I would have students, law students, where nobody in the law school agreed with me except for the three students in the Christian Legal Society or whatever who brought me there. You know, just terribly secular environments, you know. And I would have students coming up to me saying, you know, you really gave me something to think about. Wow, I never thought of that. And I thought, wow, that's victory. I have won the battle for ideas. And yet, we kept losing, you know, and nobody ever refuted my ideas. Basically, they ignored me, you know. And so it was around 2013 that I started thinking, you know, criminy, we're winning the battle of ideas, sort of, but we're not winning the war. So why is that? What in the world is going on here? So that's when I really started scratching my head and saying, what's missing from this equation in the battle of ideas?
So what has the left, what have progressives done that very often social conservatives fail to do?
So first of all, the opponents of Christianity are very good at controlling language. And I would take issue with the words you just used. These are not progressives. They're not making progress towards anything. They're leading a descent into barbarism. So you must never use their terminology. That's number one. And we're very careless about that, actually, which is a thing that an idea person can do and should do is to help clarify those type of things. So that's one point. They get a grip on the language, and then the language is like a loaded grenade. You know, if you pick up their grenade, you're going to die. So you can't use their terminology. So that's one point that they do. And they're very conscious about it, and they're very specific about it, and they enforce it pretty rigorously amongst themselves, you know, so that everybody's using their thought process and their language. But the other thing they do is they inspire action. And I don't know for a fact of some of the current things going on around us, some of the things going on, the protests and the riots and so on and so forth, some of that is probably inspired deeply by deeply felt beliefs that people have acquired, but some of it's probably paid for. And all of it is pretty well organized, one has to say, you know, so they've thought through, here's what we're trying to accomplish, here are the steps we need to take. And we need to stick with that plan and implement that plan and make sure those steps happen. So if their goal is to get the police defunded or something, they have to say that a million times so that it becomes a thing, and then take the other steps necessary to make that happen. What I think is lacking amongst conservatives generally is they have a sort of a general plan of what they want. They have something they're trying to oppose. Bad things they're trying to stop. But they're not as clear about the vision that they want to implement, number one. And number two, they're just not as good at saying, here's our plan, we're going to accomplish X, and we're going to do everything that needs to be done in order to accomplish X. That's the missing step, it seems to me, amongst conservatives. And one has to say, I have to say, Todd, of the whole conservative movement, I would say the best at this are the social conservatives, the people who are concerned about life and marriage and pornography and sex ed in the schools and so on. Those are people who are actually out there getting their hands dirty, counseling people on the sidewalks, going to school board meetings, those type of things. But the conservative movement generally is very top heavy with people who sit at think tanks and who are, you know, maybe work for a political party or something like that, but very, very little in the way of hands-on ground game, boots on the ground type of activity. The balance between, you know, the guys in the offices and the guys on the street, the balance is way off in the conservative movement overall, in my opinion.
And by those means that you just outlined, Jennifer, the left has been able to very efficiently inhabit American institutions, haven't they?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. You know, I mean, in my little article here, I recount this story, this memory that I have of being involved when I was involved in academic life. And I haven't been in academic life since 1996. So it's, I may be out of date here, but I don't think I'm out of date by much on this. I was involved in a number of libertarian and free market and conservative think tanks type things that were there to cultivate young scholars, to help us, you know, advance the ideas of liberty, advance the ideas of the free market, so on and so forth, you know. And when I look back on it, Todd, the donors and sponsors of those organizations spent millions of dollars doing this, you know. And so it's all well and good as far as it goes. But I honestly cannot remember a single time when somebody said, okay, we need to start attending the faculty senate meetings, and we need to keep track of what they're doing inside the administration. If there's a hiring committee, we need to be sure we're on it. If they're about to change the rules for this or that or the third thing, we better be sure we're in there and that our voice is heard. And in my opinion, based on my experience, I would say among conservative academics, people feel like, you know, we're here to study Cicero or Adam Smith or whatever. You know, we don't have time for that kind of thing. And, you know, so while you're in your office doing your thing, which I understand, I did it too. You know, I'm not blaming anybody here. I'm just saying I did this too. I wanted to be doing my research. I didn't want to bother with faculty senate meetings. But while we were doing that, other people were going to faculty senate meetings, and nobody knew what they were doing until it was too late to stop, you know. And I've observed this, you know, now from a distance. I've seen this at secular universities. I've seen it at universities that have a Christian heritage, which are now, in some cases, completely unrecognizable as Christian institutions. I think that many of the governing bodies of religious denominations have had the same sort of process going on. So I just feel it's time for a sober-minded look at how we're conducting ourselves and what we give priority to. You know, there are a lot of people in our pews who would be happy to help us if we gave them something to do, you know. And so we need you to sign this petition. We need you to show up here. We need you to write this letter. There are a lot of people who'd be willing to do that if we had thought through a strategy about when it was worthwhile to do that and what they should say and so on and so forth, you know. We just need to divert more of our attention into that area.
We hear a lot of phrases, those of us who value truth, and I want you to react to a few of them. One of them being, well, the truth is on our side and the truth will out. It will in the end win. What do you make of that response?
Well, of course, I believe in truth too and value truth and so on, but there's no guarantee that the end will come within your lifetime or within your children's lifetime or anything like that. And if that phrase is an invitation to quietism, then it's a dangerous phrase and it needs to be discarded. You know, it's not an excuse to do nothing.
You point out that while the Soviet Union certainly did collapse, it did not collapse of itself just because it was founded on a lot of very bad ideas.
Well, that's true. And, you know, as a free market economist, I used to think that. I used to think, well, this system is so inefficient, it's so crazy, they can't compete with us. The natural process of that will be that we will outcompete them and they will just implode. Now, there's some truth to that, but we must not forget that at the same time that that little process was going on, Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan and Pope St. John Paul II were giving the thing a good shove. They were putting pressure on it in various ways and making it even harder for them to compete and making the weaknesses even more apparent, you know. So the policies that they concretely and specifically took had real consequences. And if we were just going to wait around for it to collapse of its own weight, we might still be waiting. And that's not really an acceptable outcome, as far as I'm concerned.
So why do you think it is that social conservatives are willing to take activist steps on some subjects? And I'm thinking here about abortion. They are willing to get in there and fight, and I'm glad that they are. But on other subjects related to the sexual revolution, they sit it out.
Well, you got a couple things at work there. First of all, the abortion issue was never driven by intellectuals, and nobody ever expected to be driven by intellectuals. The pro-life movement has been a grassroots movement of ordinary men and women in the pews from the beginning, okay? And I know on the Catholic side, you know, we kind of had to nudge our bishops and our priests to get involved, you know? But it's a genuine grassroots movement. Everyone can understand what the problem is with it. Anybody who has a halfway decently formed Christian conscience can see the problem with it. And so it was never driven from the top down. It was always driven from the bottom up, which is, you know, continues to be its great strength, in my opinion. But the other issues that have come up since then, whether it be no-fault divorce, whether it be pornography, whether it be the proper definition of marriage, and now transgenderism, these issues, I think there are a couple reasons why people don't get involved. In some cases, people are impeded by a guilty conscience. And we see this on the abortion issue as well, but it's, I think, especially pronounced with divorce and now pornography. These are things a lot of people have experience with, and they haven't really come to terms with it. They haven't fully repented of it. They haven't fully healed of it. So they kind of trip over their own consciences as they try to speak out about it. So they might say, in their minds, they may say, well, you know, I know this is wrong, but, you know, I just don't really want to talk about it. You know, I just don't want to deal with it. Or, you know, I might have to explain why I got a divorce, or, you know, why I'm married to a divorced person, or whatever. So I think our theology actually helps us with our sociology here, because our theology tells us that if you're walking around with a guilty conscience, you're going to be burdened by that and you're going to be impeded by that. So that insight into the guilty conscience problem is something that has propelled us quite a bit at the Ruth Institute to just pay attention to the ways in which people are stumbling over their guilty consciences. And so we've learned to speak about some of the issues a little differently, so that we can convey to people that we're not judging them, that we're not saying you're a terrible person because you got divorced. We're more apt to say something like, you know, when 50% of marriages end in divorce, or when 70% of babies born to people with a high school education, 70% of them are to unmarried women. When it's that widespread, there's a bigger structural problem than somebody just being a bad person. You know, there are structural things that are wrong here, and that's what we have to deal with, you know. So it kind of takes some of that burden off of people. But you see, this is where what we've done at the Ruth Institute is, yes, to work on ideas, to think through the ideas, but then to implement them. It affects how we're acting. And we are definitely not sitting at our desks just talking to other intellectuals. You know, we're definitely out there talking to normal people about their normal problems, you know. I get emails, Todd, from people with all kinds of problems that I never would have thought I'd be dealing with as an economics professor. And, you know, honestly, as a conservative free market professor or whatever, I would have just kind of dismissed those people. And I see now that you can't do that. I can't do that. I was wrong to do that. And we must take seriously those people who don't have advanced degrees, but who care passionately about these issues and who are being harmed by the misguided policies that we're all living under. You know, it's very important to take those people seriously. And I think the social conservatives have done the best job of that. And the pro-life community has done the best job with that. And, you know, the fiscal conservatives and the foreign policy conservatives, if there even is such a thing anymore, the American founding guys, you know, all of those different little branches of conservatism, they don't even know that there is anybody who doesn't have an advanced degree. You know, they don't even talk to those people. So that's the problem that I'm reacting to in my thoughts here, Todd, and in trying to guide the policies of the Ruth Institute and how we're going to get things done.
Finally, then, with about a minute here, Jennifer, you talk about what we have on our side by way of ideas, really the big idea to counter the sexual revolution. What is that big idea?
Well, the big idea, the short version of it, is that we as people of faith believe that the human person is made for love, that we were loved into existence by God, and that we are meant for love. The way that plays out is that God created every single person as an act of love for that particular person. And God's plan for us is that we bring each new person into being as the result of an act of love. God wants every person to come into being as a result of an act of love between their mother and their father. Of course, God's participation is always love. Every person is loved into existence by God, and God wants us to mirror that. And the way that we connect with our sex partners and the way we connect with our children. And to me, this is an inspiring and uplifting idea. This is true equality. Even a poor person can have parents who love each other. There's no reason they can't. And we've completely wiped that out of our society now, you know. But I think that if we start from that premise that the human person is meant for love and is loved into existence by God, that that is an inspiring vision for creating a civilization of love.
Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse is founder and president of the Ruth Institute. She taught economics for 15 years at Yale and George Mason Universities. She's senior research fellow in economics for the Acton Institute, author of several books, including her latest, The Sexual State, and a recent column for the American Mind titled Ideas Don't Have Consequences. You'll find a link to this column, to The Sexual State, and to the Ruth Institute at issuesetc.org. Click Talk on Demand Archives. Jennifer, thanks.
You're very welcome.
Mark Hemingway, senior writer for Real Clear Investigations, joins us on the other side of the break to talk about intellectual diversity and higher education. You can watch and hear Mark and Molly Hemingway, Robert George, Matt Walsh, Brian Wolfmiller, and Hans Feeney at the 2020 Virtual Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. Making the Case is Friday, July 24th and Saturday, July 25th. All paid registrants will have the ability to watch the conference live and on demand. For more information, visit issuesetc.org or give us a call 618-223-8385.
The Simply Classical curriculum for special needs moves at my child's pace and gives her exactly what she needs. So writes Amber, a homeschooling mother who has joined thousands in homes and schools teaching from this uniquely Christian classical approach to special education. Teach students with autism, learning disabilities, or Down syndrome based on ability level rather than chronological age. Use promo code LPR20 today at classicalspecialneeds.com. Classicalspecialneeds.com.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues Etc.
The church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century. The 16th century. The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.